Hello and welcome back to Tanya 200. We're going through the Tanya on its 200th anniversary since its first printing, and we're up to chapter 12. In the first 11 chapters, the Alter Rebbe was basically setting the groundwork, the introduction to the character for whom the Beinoni was written, for whom the Tanya was written, and that is the Beinoni. The Beinoni is neither a tzaddik nor a rasha. He is not a saint, nor does he sin. He's someplace in between. And of course, that's always the hardest thing to understand. The tzaddik does not sin because the tzaddik cannot sin. The tzaddik can't sin because there is no attraction, there is no desire for the tzaddik in that which is sinful. In his heart of hearts, he has no appetite for that which is unholy, and therefore his freedom of choice must exist within the world of goodness itself, between good and better, between holy and holier, between godly and godlier, but not between the good and the evil, because he has no capacity, not even internally, not even in his heart of hearts, for anything unholy. Within the level of tzaddik, there are tens of thousands of degrees of how completely, how utterly despised the evil is, and how completely and how utterly does the tzaddik find pleasure and love exclusively in God. When it comes to a sinner, we also find tens of thousands of degrees, different kinds of license that a person gives themselves to sin. One person will allow himself to sin in a very restricted way, in a very restrained way. He doesn't sin casually, he doesn't sin carelessly, he doesn't sin recklessly, but he will commit a sin. He'll be careful about which garment or which part of his behavior he will allow to sin, whether it's thought or speech or action. Some people would rather sin in thought because it's abstract. Some people would rather not sin in thought because it's very delicate and hard to fix. Some people would rather sin in action because it's merely an act. Some people would rather not sin in action because it's too concrete and real. Some people won't sin in speech because it's also part of your personality and delicate. Some people would rather sin in speech because it's neither concrete like action, nor is it as sensitive as thought. So you have different kinds of perceptions among people where the sinning is restrained or restricted to one of the three garments. You also find a person who is completely controlled by his appetite and therefore will sin in an unrestrained fashion. He cannot select which garment he's going to sin in. He will sin in all three garments. And he will not have regrets like the first kind of sinner. He won't have any regrets because his godly soul is silent within him and is never heard from. So what we now have is this. We have a tzaddik who cannot sin, and we have the sinner who can sin. So what makes a sinner a sinner? Not the amount of sins, not even the type of sins. What makes him a sinner is the fact that he can violate a commandment. And that's because he finds pleasure in it, it's appealing to him, he wants it, and he cannot control the garments, the thought, the speech, or the deed, which the appetite or the desire demands. The Beinoni, which we're going to talk about in chapter 12, the Beinoni is incapable of sinning in the garments, in the thought, speech, and deed, not because he finds no pleasure in sin, not because he has no attraction, feels no attraction to the unholy, but because if you're not allowed, then you're not allowed. He's neither a saint nor a sinner. He will not commit the sin, but not out of saintliness. He will not commit the sin. He cannot allow himself to sin, unlike the sinner who can. The Beinoni cannot, but unlike the tzaddik, it's not because he has no pleasure or love for that which is sinful, but because he's not permitted. And to the Beinoni, not being permitted means it's out of the question. Can't. Now, realistically speaking, kind of off the record, there were times when people tried very hard to be saintly. They actually thought they could become saints. They were also convinced that that was the goal, that if you're going to practice goodness, if you're going to be religious, the objective is to become a saint. Anything less than that is failure. That was very frustrating for most people because it's simply not true. What the Rebbe is telling us in Tanya is that the average person, the average nice person, is not a saint, not even an imperfect saint. In fact, not even a Beinoni. Because if a sinner is someone who commits a sin just once in one of the garments and regrets it, and yet he is a sinner because he committed the sin, and his regret does not guarantee that he will not sin again, well then that's where we are all at. That's your average person, your average good person. So if we were to describe ourselves honestly, we would have to say that according to this breakdown, according to the definitions provided in Tanya, we are all imperfect sinners. But then what's our goal? What do we strive for? What's the next step up that we can get to? The next step up is where we bring ourselves to a level where although we still have an appetite for what's unholy, the thought of actually committing the sin is impossible, because if you're not allowed, then it's out of the question. Here, a practical example. You walk past a store window and you see something in the store window that is very appealing. You're very attracted to it. You very much would love or desire to have this product. But then you take a look at the price tag, and it's way, way out of your reach. Can't afford this. So you take a deep breath, you sigh, and you keep on walking, because this is not for you. It's just much too expensive. That's a Beinoni. If you can't afford it, then it's not yours. You keep walking. Doesn't mean you don't like it. Doesn't mean you don't, you can't imagine the pleasure you would have if you could afford the product. But look at the price tag. Can't afford it. So you keep on walking. If a person lingers in front of the store and he's thinking, well, I can't pay for it, what other possibility might there be for me to get this product without having to pay for it? This is not a Beinoni anymore. This is a sinner, because he's entertaining the thought, he's entertaining the possibility that although this is beyond his ability, although this is beyond what he could afford, maybe there's some other way that he could get what isn't his. Maybe he's sitting here coming back later at night with a brick in his hand and helping himself to what's in the store window. even if he doesn't actually do it, he's not a Beinoni anymore. Because a Beinoni can't consider taking what isn't his. He can't consider doing what isn't permitted. It's almost like, to the Beinoni, God is present, and therefore, he can't sin. If God would go away, if God would turn his back, if God would not pay attention for a while, maybe you could consider thinking. But with God sitting right there watching, how could you even think of sinning? Even when a human being is watching, you can't think of sinning. So the sinner is someone to whom God's presence is not real. He doesn't feel God's presence. So to the sinner, it's like nobody's looking. Nobody's looking, well, then maybe you can help yourself to the product in the window. So a Beinoni can't sin like a tzaddik. But unlike the tzaddik, the Beinoni is restrained from sinning by God's presence, not by something internal, not by his own internal workings, that deep down inside he has no pleasure in sin and has no love for the sinful and so on. It's not an internal process. It is an external process. God keeps him from sinning by being present. So God's presence prevents him from sinning. Can he sin? No, he cannot sin. But what keeps him from sinning is not the him, it's not something inside of him. What keeps him from sinning is God's desire or God's interest, God's interference in his life. In that way, he's like the Russia. He could sin, he'd like to sin. He would appreciate the sin. He would enjoy the sin. Unlike the Russia, he can't actually do it. The Russia will find a way to actually do it. So the sinner is one who will try to sin because God's presence doesn't prevent him from doing it. The Beinoni is someone who cannot do the sin because God is present and you just can't. Now here's how, in chapter 12, the Tanya describes the Beinoni. The Beinoni is the kind of a person who will not commit the sin in thought, speech, or action, but does not despise evil. And therefore, every person should strive to be a Beinoni, because everyone can be a Beinoni at any point in life, at any stage in life, regardless of what preceded this moment. Which means a Beinoni is not born that way. A person can be sinful on either level of the imperfect sinner or the perfect sinner, and at any stage in life he is capable of becoming a Beinoni. A Beinoni is not a sinner, not because he's never sinned, but because he has recognized God's presence to such a degree that it will now prevent him from sinning. A Beinoni is not a tzaddik, not because he has sinned. That's not what makes him a Beinoni. What makes him a Beinoni is, now that he will not again sin, it's not because of his inner self, but because of God's presence that prevents him from sinning. And therefore, every person can be a Beinoni, because being a Beinoni does not include transforming your inner being. It doesn't mean despising evil. It doesn't mean losing your appetite for human pleasures. It doesn't include that. The Beinoni does have an appetite for human pleasures, but he can't afford certain pleasures, and therefore he won't do it. It's out of the question. There are moments in the life of a Beinoni when he feels like a tzaddik. When he's concentrated on godliness, when he's absorbed in prayer, for example, when his mind is focused on God, and he's thinking about God's kindness or God's goodness or God's greatness, for the duration of that prayer, he can actually experience an inner state of being that is similar to the tzaddik, which means that during the focus, during the prayer, his love for God is so active, it is so stimulated, that it silences all other emotions. And for the duration of the prayer, he doesn't feel a conflict within himself. He doesn't have dual feelings. He's not torn in two directions. He has only one love. He has only one interest. He has only one desire. And that's godly. However, when the prayer is over, when he's no longer focused on God, when he goes into other activities, that mood, that awareness is gone. And the human soul or the animal soul is like having been asleep. It now wakes up and it's back with its desires, with its demands, with its opinions and so on. And he again has a duality in his heart. However, in this awareness of the pleasures of the world, the Beinoni has no thought of doing. He notices the pleasure. He does not consider the act. He understands why others might be doing this, because he can see the pleasure one could have. But it never enters his mind, I would like to. He doesn't like to. He doesn't want to. He doesn't want to sin. And so doing it is out of the question. So after the prayer, after the davening, that single-mindedness, the single-heartedness that he felt is gone, and he now again feels a divided heart. But there's a benefit. There's an after-effect. There's a lingering effect that the prayer has, in that he has refined himself to some degree, so that the desire is not as strong as it was. The distraction is not as intense as it was. The resistance is not as intense as it was. Prayer has had an effect. And every time the Beinoni prays this way and enables himself, indulges in this single-heartedness, enjoys, luxuriates in those moments where he feels only one feeling and is not in conflict, that has an effect on the rest of the day and possibly on the rest of his life, where although he is still a Beinoni, he has not become a tzaddik at all, yet he has the ability to move ahead in this struggle between the godly and the human to where the struggle has become less intense, the interference from the animal soul has become less intense, and so on. So we have many degrees of Beinoni within the Beinoni. Now, in this struggle, which the devil will describe in great length in future chapters, but here the Rebbe says that when the Beinoni has this struggle between the demands or the feelings of the animal soul and the demands and the feelings of the godly soul, the Beinoni is capable of dismissing the demands of his natural soul without doing himself any psychological harm. He is not repressing his nature or his personality, because we are created by nature, by our natural state, with the ability or the power of the mind to to control the heart. Which means that by our very nature, the heart and the mind have a relationship in which the heart obeys the mind and the mind controls the heart. That's to say that when you refuse an unholy impulse, you're not only being pious, you're not only being good or religious, you're not only following a dictate, a command, an ideal that comes from the outside of your system, but you're actually using your system in its natural function. Because it is natural that the mind control the heart, because that's the way they were created, that is their native or natural interaction. The way that they get along, the way that they act with each other, is that the mind controls the heart. Now, of course, we find many cases where the heart overwhelms the mind, where a person is governed by his appetites rather than his intellect, where a person is held captive by his emotions. This is a common thing. It's not necessarily a natural thing. Naturally, the heart, the emotions, look to the intellect, look to the mind for guidance and instruction. In fact, when a person feels that his emotions are out of control, it frightens him because it doesn't feel natural. It doesn't feel right. It's frightening. When the heart looks to the mind for guidance and doesn't find it, the heart panics. So it's not that the emotions refuse or resist influence from the mind. The exact opposite is true. All emotion depends on the mind because the emotions are a reaction, a response to something. And what that something is up to the mind to provide. So if the mind tells you we are in serious trouble, then the heart panics. If the mind says, this is great, things are wonderful, then the heart relaxes and enjoys. But without the mind, the emotions have no clue. They have no ability to respond because they don't know how they should be responding. The mind must provide that information. So when the mind says no to an impulse in the heart actually welcomes it, like a child who welcomes discipline. Because the child knows, I can't function on my own. I have feelings, but I don't know what to do with them. Somebody better tell me. The heart has feelings that may not be coming from the mind, but the heart wants instruction, guidance, control, discipline from the mind so that it would know what to do with the emotions that it's feeling. So by our very nature, the mind controls the heart. Particularly when it comes to the question of the choice between the godly and the ungodly. King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, says, I have seen, I've come to the conclusion after much research, that there is a benefit to wisdom over foolishness, like the benefit of light over darkness. This needs a little explanation. Solomon was the wisest of all men, and this took him a whole lifetime to figure out that wisdom is better than foolishness. And he needs an example. Like, you won't understand this, so I'll give you an example. It's like light is better than darkness. What is the wisdom of this conclusion? And why does something so obvious need an example? Better to know than not to know. It's better to be smart than to be foolish. What Solomon is saying is not that it's better to be smart than stupid. Wisdom has a power over foolishness like light has a power over darkness. the relationship between light and darkness, aside from the fact that it's better to have light than to have darkness, which is rather obvious. What is the relationship between darkness and light? When you turn the light on in a dark room, what happens? The darkness disappears instantaneously, without a struggle. It does not resist the light. It doesn't say, hey, I've been here longer than you, so I'm staying. And the light has to overpower it and throw it out. The darkness disappears immediately. Why so? Because darkness exists only by the absence of light. So it's the absence of light that gave it its existence. When the light is no longer absent, it can't resist. It disappears immediately. Also, a lot of darkness disappears in the presence of a little bit of light. You bring a small candle into a big room, the entire room is not as dark as it was. The same is true with foolishness and wisdom. King Solomon says, foolishness does not exist as a reality on its own. It's the absence of wisdom. And when you bring wisdom in, then a little bit of wisdom dispels a lot of foolishness, and it dispels it effortlessly. It's not unnatural that the wisdom dispels the foolishness. So when you bring the wisdom of the mind into the foolishness of the heart doesn't resist. It is natural that the heart respond immediately to the wisdom of the mind and do as the mind says, rather than fight it or resist it and argue it. And so when the Beinoni wants to do what is right, even while his heart feels the pleasure of that which is wrong, he will do what is right, and the heart will not resist, because once you bring in the light, the darkness is gone. Once you bring in the wisdom, the foolishness dissolves. So what King Solomon was saying is not that I would rather be wise than foolish. He is saying that the wisdom and the foolishness are the light and dark side of the same coin, so that the dark side can't resist the light side. So the Beinoni has two things in his favor when he comes to resolving the conflict that he feels within himself. One is the mind, by nature, controls the heart. And the second, wisdom, by nature, controls foolishness. So the wisdom of the holy versus the foolishness of the unholy offer no struggle. And this is why King Solomon says, I have seen. Not I've understood, because that's not enough. When you see your own passion, your own appetite, your own weaknesses dissolve without a struggle when you bring in the wisdom, then you see, not just know, you see that darkness is not real, only the light is real.